So anyway, since environmental economics is in the title for this course, and since a number of you have already taken a course in environmental economics, I thought we should spend a little bit of time talking about what would happen in a course in environmental economics and how it would be different than what's going to happen here. You know, this is a course more about ethics and economics in general, with applications to the environment, because I just happen to know more about the environment than I know about other aspects of economics. What is environmental economics courses do? Well, they look at natural resources and environmental resources. So when we think of natural resources, we think of things like trees, fish in the ocean, minerals in the ground, oil, gas, that sort of thing. When we think of environmental resources, we think of the air, we think of ecosystems, we think of wild animals, parks, that sort of thing. I mean, that the line between the two is really pretty blurred. So we consider, if you'd like, the allocation of natural resources and environmental resources. In natural resources course, there's more of an emphasis on natural resources, conventional natural resources like minerals and oil and fish and trees and all that kind of crap. And in environmental economics, there's more of an emphasis on the other sorts of ones we talked about a second ago. Now, we consider the allocation of those resources in the same way an economist would consider any other allocation of resources, labor, capital, that sort of thing. So what we think about is, we think about the efficient and equitable use of society's scarce environmental resources. And like in any other course, so a labor economics course or a course about land, we think about it generally from four perspectives. We think about the market allocation. In other words, if you left the market to its own devices, how would these resources be allocated? Then we think about an efficient allocation. Will they be allocated efficiently by the market? Yes or no. If the market allocation is not efficient, we call that what? A failure of the market, market failures. And then let's say there is this wedge between the market allocation and the efficient allocation. Then we think about ways the government might step in to modify or usurp the workings of the market to make the allocation more efficient. Correct the market failure, if you'd like. The other thing we consider is the equity, the fairness of the allocation. And sometimes we want the government to step in to make things fair. Like with the minimum wage thing, you might argue, for example, that increasing the minimum wage, depending on your model, might make the allocation of labor more inefficient, but it might be fairer in some sense. But when we do that, and when we do that in most economics courses, we take as given that the goal is what? The goal is efficiency and the goal is equity. And that's one of the things we're going to look at in this course. Why are they so keen on efficiency, for example? And why do they prefer more efficient allocations over less efficient? So what isn't a course in economics or economics per se? You know, as economists, our primary interest isn't in how to run a firm or how to make money or how not to make money. I mean, we can talk about theories of the firm and how firms behave, but what we're studying is what? The allocation of resources. So in those kind of courses, you know, we're not there to argue, say, that the government action is good, that we need more government intervention or we need less. You know, it's not a lot of econ courses tend to be what I'd call pro-market courses, you know. The market is a good thing, Adam Smith's invisible foot, all that kind of stuff. And sometimes when we talk about environmental resources, the market does a very good job, and sometimes it does a very lousy job. When we think about courses in environmental economics, we often talk about market failures. Cases where what the market does is inefficient. And there's going to be some of that in this course as well. So some of that study of market failures. If we think about the market as an institution to do the right thing, to do good in an ethical sense of the word, sometimes it does good. Sometimes it does bad. It often does bad in the case of environmental resources and natural resources. So that's going to have to be something that we're cognizant of. Now, another thing we do in those courses is we talk about the costs and benefits of, say, reducing pollution, or having more parks, or cleaning up the environment, or reducing your chances of getting cancer in 20 years. There's a tendency, if you'd like, to say, well, we're going to make these decisions on efficiency grounds, we're going to look at the benefits, and we're going to look at the costs. And we don't want to ban cigarette smoking in public unless the gain to the gainers is greater than the loss to the losers. Now, in those courses, we typically would say what? The gain to the gainers, the loss to the losers, but who would we include when we tallied up gainers and losers? Would we include French people? Would we include future generations? Would we include animals? And that's a topic we're going to consider more in here than we did in there. There, the tendency was more to say, people now, people in the future, but maybe not count them as much as people now, and don't worry too much about foreigners. At least if that's what your boss says. I mean, kind of, as economists, it's not always up to you to decide what society is. If you're hired by someone to do a benefit-cost analysis, they're going to tell you who they want the analysis done on. And you might be going, well, what about the bears in the woods? What about the bears in the woods? And they're going to say to you, we're not paying you to care about the bears in the woods. So there's some overlap between those courses and this course, but hopefully I can make it sufficiently different so if you've already taken it, this will be of some interest. We already all know where the web page for the course is. The top one is my web page. I've taught a lot of other courses in environmental economics and resource economics in this department, and they all have web pages. And those might be of interest for you in terms of your essays, because there's lots of readings and notes and things like that on different topics on different web pages. So you might, or you just, you're just, okay, good enough. So, office hours Tuesday after class. Prerequisites, I think you're supposed to have taken intermediate micro. A course in environmental resources or natural resources wouldn't be a bad thing, but it's not necessary. A lot of what we're going to be doing is related to public finance. You know, if you've taken an ethics course or philosophy course, you probably know more about it than I do. That's maybe good or that's maybe bad. I'm not sure. As we said last time, there's no textbook for the course. I'll post all the required readings on the course on the webpage. This section we're going to start now about production, consumption, and the environment, there's now, I've added a couple more readings to it. So there's the article by Canessa. Then yesterday I made active chapter 2 in a book by Pearson Turner called The Circular Economy. And just now, right before class, I added a third article, a very, very short article by Kenneth Boulding, very, very famous economist. He actually retired from this department the year I started in this department. It's called The Spaceship Earth. And it thinks of the Earth like you think of a spaceship. So let's say you were in a spaceship and you couldn't add any material or get rid of any material. So it was a closed system in terms of materials, but you did have an outside energy source called the SUN. You know, if you think of the Earth that way, sort of traveling through space, how would we manage it differently than we do? you know, when you think about the environment on a spaceship, it's very up close and personal. You go to the bathroom and you're not careful, and it's going to be what? Floating all around the room. Okay, probably two. Okay, you got to help me figure out how to do this mentoring thing. And I think that's pretty much it.
I have a question about the readings.
Yeah.
I was looking at the website, and so, like, if at the end of class you said, well, I have a reading for next Tuesday.
Right.
We should just keep going in sequential order, just doing the next one down?
Well, right now, let's look at the reading list right now. And as some of you know, I like to put like tons of stuff on the reading list, but then people sort of don't read it all. Or if there's too much stuff, they don't read any of it, right? So, well, you know, I think that I don't know. Let me give you for an example. So we're going to start this section now, production, consumption, and the environment. So the first thing is there's a set of notes by me, right? I definitely would like you to read those. In a perfect world, though, you won't have to come to class, well, if you don't want the participation part of your grade, because of course I'll figure out how to plot all this in terms of a WAV file and everything, and you can just sit at home and listen to it on your iTunes, right? Okay. The one thing I asked you to read for today to sort of get you going was this article, the one by Kinesa. Now, I could have just stopped there and put nothing else on this section. But, you know, it's like when you write a term paper. You do a bunch of research, and you say, well, I read all this crap. It doesn't have anything to do with anything, but I'm going to put it in my term paper either way. Right? That's not quite the case here, okay? The other thing I put up was basically an article. Pearson Turner is a textbook in environmental economics that tends to have sort of an ecological, ethical slant to it. And it's got a chapter called The Circular Economy, which is basically about materials balance or what's discussed in the Kinesa article. But it's a textbook, it's another way of looking at it. You know, if you read this one and didn't read that one, that would be fine for me, unless I asked you a specific review question like, what did Pearson Turner say on page 4? You know, I wouldn't put it quite like that, but I could ask you a question specifically about a reading. This one, it's a very interesting read. It's a very famous article. It'll take you 5 minutes. I would expect you to read it.
Which one?
The one by Kenneth Folden. Earth as a spaceship. Does that sort of answer your question? Now, another thing you can do to make things more reasonable for people in the future is you can give me feedback, like after, you know, you're of course going to read all of those things, right, in detail, and then you could send me an email saying, well, you know, I really like this one and I think this would really be good for future students, but I don't think this one's really worth the time. Alternatively, you can say, I've even got a better one for you. Like in the process of writing your essays, you might come across stuff that you think everyone else should read. Now, that's another thing about the essays and the length of the essays. One of the things that you can do to keep the length of your essay short, so somebody doesn't look at it and go, oh God, I'm not reading this, is to put what? To put links in it. Like I was making up today notes on material balance, right? And I thought I better say something about the first and second laws of thermodynamics. So I sort of went to a web page and I got a little bit of an excerpt. So I gave you like the 3-sentence definition. And then I put in the link, so if somebody wants to know more about that, they can go to a source. Okay, materials balance, or what comes out must go back in. So as an environmental economist, when I think about the world or I think about the economy, I think about it the following way. I think of production and consumption on one hand, and then I think of emissions, waste, and pollution on the other hand, and I think of them as two sides of the same coin, basically two sides of the exact same process. And here's why I think of them this way. Remind me to fill in teeter-totter when we get to teeter-totter. What do we do when we produce and consume things? Everything that we consume and produce at some point originated where? Originated in the environment. So, the process of production, if you'd like, an important part of that process is to remove stuff from the environment. Then we produce and consume things. A little bit of it gets recycled. In some places, more gets recycled than less. And eventually, it all ends up where? All of it ends up back in the environment. So this is where the teeter-totter comes in. If you think about it for a bit, this should be fairly obvious. The total weight of what we take from the environment for production and consumption eventually has to equal the total weight of what goes back into the environment. That's where the word balance comes from. What was it, T-E-E? Teeter dash Why is that? Well, it basically comes as a variation of the first law of thermodynamics, which basically implies that unless you've got an antimatter machine, we can't create matter or destroy matter. So when we think about it, what we do when we produce things and consume things is we basically rearrange the matter. We're not really making anything new in the sense that there's new material. And when we consume things, we're not making the material go away. We're just changing its form. Now, at the end of the process, if it doesn't come out in one form, it's got to come out in another form.
Wait, how is this different than the spaceship analogy?
It's not, terribly. That's why I put the spaceship analogy as one of the readings.
That's his argument?
His argument is that we should think of the Earth as a closed system that's only got a finite amount of material. His argument is more of a historical argument. He starts off by saying that, you know, in the olden days, there weren't that many people. And there was a lot of stuff versus the number of people, right? So historically, we didn't really have to worry that much about resource scarcity in terms of taking stuff out of the environment. Another point that he made, and I'm going to make here, is an important role of the environment is a place for us to put our junk, you know. We consume it, and then it all goes back into the environment, right? Now, if there's only a few people, and the Earth is really big, it all has to go back in the environment, but the spaceship analogy is not that appropriate in the sense that when we think of a spaceship, we think of it as something fairly small relative to the number of people, right? So he's saying we're getting to the point where we have to consider the Earth to be a closed system in terms of materials, which is kind of another way of saying that there's a certain amount of material in the system. Sometimes it's here, sometimes it's there, and we mess around with that material, but we've got to live with all the material, and we don't have more material that we can harvest from somewhere else. Unless, of course, we go to the moon and, you know,
find a new spaceship
or whatever. Now, the important point in this box here, one of the important points, is everything that's produced and consumed had its origins in the environment. Trees, plants, all that kind of stuff. So when I think of production and consumption, I think of them as just a rearrangement of things. When you produce something, what do? And we talked about this a little bit last time. You take stuff, sometimes raw materials, sometimes things that have already been produced. You combine them to turn them into some new product. What do you use to do that? What drives the rearrangement of stuff? Basically, energy. We use energy to rearrange the stuff. Now, when we produce stuff, if we were in a mathematics class now, I describe production as something where we produce a vector of things or an array of things rather than a single product. You know, when we think about the firm in intermediate micro, we think of the firm as producing product X, right? In the real world, a firm produces a whole vector of products or a whole vector of commodities, even if they only sell one of them. So you think about what a firm produces. It takes stuff in and then it emits stuff out the door. Some of that stuff is stuff that people want. Either consumers want or other firms want. And if people want it or firms want it, then you can do what with it? You can sell it for money. And that's why they're doing this rearranging in the first place. But there's a lot of other crap that comes out the door as well. And we'll call that other stuff emissions or non-market emissions. Basically, the waste materials associated with production. Those things take different forms. Some of those forms are fairly innocuous. Some of those forms are what? Quite noxious. You know, some might just be junk that just sits there, and we'd rather not look at the junk, or we'd rather not it take up space, but it's not going to give anybody cancer or anything. You know, other stuff we can think of as toxic chemicals or nuclear waste or whatever that might give you birth defects or your kids' birth defects or cancer or whatever. So these emissions can take a lot of different forms. So I'm going to make a distinction between emissions and pollution. Pollution would be a type of emission. Sort of the noxious emissions are pollutants. The less noxious ones, the ones we don't care much about either way, we can call those emissions, we can call them waste, but maybe we won't put the designation pollution on them. So that's what happens when we produce stuff. Factory takes inputs, they rearrange them, blah, blah, blah. Again, the total weight of what? The total weight of all the stuff that goes in the factory door on the one side has to equal the total weight of what goes out the door or up through the smokestacks or into the air on the other side. Now, sometimes it takes a long time for all that stuff to make it through. Like if you buy a big new machine to run your factory, that's a big input going in the door. And what's going to happen? Every year, only a small part of it, in terms of depreciation, is going to go out the other end, up in smoke, if you'd like. But eventually, everything's going to make it through the system. So in the long run, the weight's going to balance. I was trying to come up with some examples this morning. I was trying to think of how much stuff it takes to produce something and actually how much that weighs compared to how much the stuff that you're going to sell actually weighs. You start with a tree and you shave it away. Are the shavings greater than the back though, or?
Depends on how efficient.
I guess it depends on how efficient you are. I mean, I was thinking about marble statues, you know, where you start off with some big hunk of marble and very possibly the pile of junk laying at the side at the end of the day is greater than the weight of the statue, right? But trees are a good example. If you think about cutting down trees to make lumber, how much of that lumber and branches and leaves and twigs and all that actually ends up at the lumber yard? Probably what? Probably more of it doesn't than does. I mean, even if you think about creating a meal, I was thinking about Big Macs. You know, you go to McDonald's, you get your drive-up window, you get your Big Mac, and all of a sudden, right, the Big Mac is gone, or at least it's in your stomach, it hasn't disappeared, but what's left, there's cardboard and paper and ketchup containers and cups and all those laying all over the floor of your car. Now, they probably don't weigh as much as the Big Mac, but they do weigh something. So, some emissions take up space, but other than that, really don't cause a lot of injury or harm. Other emissions cause injury. You know, so if you move out of your house and you leave a couch on the front porch, that's not going to kill anybody of cancer, but it does take up space and it might bother the neighbors and stuff. You know, as compared to dumping toxic chemicals, that sort of thing, which might cause very severe injuries. So that's production. Now, when we talk about consumption is really a type of production as well. We take stuff and we do what? We rearrange the stuff. Again, in terms of materials, we don't create any new material and no material goes away. It's a rearrangement of stuff. When we think of consumption, we probably use the word consumption in the sense that the stuff does sort of go away in the sense that it gets broken down. You know, you think about different products. So if we think about food, obviously it gets broken down pretty quickly. We chew on it, et cetera, and we know the result. Right? Other stuff takes much longer to break down. You know, Michelangelo's David has been around for a long time. It is deteriorating. I recently did a study on the deterioration rate of monuments in Washington, D.C. caused by acid rain, and monuments are definitely being washed away. But it's a pretty slow process compared to what happens to a Big Mac in your stomach. You know, cars are somewhere in between, cars, stereos, that sort of thing. They do what? They break down. Now, what kind of drives this process of rearrangement? Just like with production, it's driven by what? It's driven by energy. You chew on it, you hit it, you know, you smash the ball against the wall, etc. How do you ruin a baseball bat? Hit a really big home run or hold it wrong when you hit the ball, but obviously that takes what? That takes energy to convert the baseball bat into a whole bunch of splinters. So, it would be interesting to do the following as an essay. You know, you could go home starting today and for the next month, you could weigh everything you purchase. You could weigh everything you throw away before you put it in the garbage can, put it on the scale, weigh it all, and see what kind of relationship you get between the two. Or you'd at least have to explain in your essay that that might be one of the reasons why things don't balance, right?
Couldn't you just weigh yourself?
Yeah.
Well, obviously, you as part of this process, you should weigh yourself.
Before and after.
Oh, before and after. I hadn't thought of it that way. I mean, one way to store this stuff is to do what? Right there, right? So one reason you'd want to weigh yourself is that, you know, you could be... There's this great Italian word for, what is it, grande pancia, or something like that, a grand punch, right? For converting things like Big Macs into this big attractive belly, right? So yeah, you'd want to weigh yourself, right? Now, the other thing you'd have to keep track of is a lot of the weight goes out when you do what? When you exhale. A lot of gases go up into the air. And that's going on all the time. And that weighs stuff too. But how do you spell Caesar?
C-A-E.
So did I spell it wrong?
There's no E at the end.
Oh, you know what? I spelled it the Italian way. Cesare. So S-E-A.
C-A-E.
C-A-E.
Then S-A-R.
Like that?
Yeah.
Okay. So if everything ends up back in the environment, why aren't we buried in everyone's old junk? Where does it all go, right? I mean, we produced a lot of garbage over the last 100,000 years or whatever. You know, waste products, dead bodies, old Barbies, buildings, etc., etc. But it's not all still around. Why is that? The environment is not just a place where we can dump our waste, but it's also a place that what? Transforms our waste. Or said another way, the environment has a what? It has some ability to assimilate our waste products and turn them into other things. So the environment has got an assimilative capacity. So when we think about what we get from the environment, one, it's the source of all our inputs. Two, it's a place where we can dump the byproducts. But luckily for us, it's the kind of garbage dump that does what? That actually takes our garbage and messes around with it to do what? To actually form stuff that we will, in the future, think of as inputs. Now, the environment's got a limited ability to do this, though. You know, it's got a capacity, an assimilative capacity. It only can assimilate so much. If you try and get it to assimilate more than that so much, it starts to do what? It starts to break down. And it's better at assimilating certain types of things than other types of things. I hate to use the word natural, but the more natural the output, probably the better job the environment's going to do in breaking it down. So if we're talking about biological waste from humans or plant waste or whatever, the environment is pretty good at breaking that stuff down. On the other hand, there's other sorts of wastes that what? Toxic chemicals, nuclear waste, that sort of thing, that the environment doesn't really have a lot of experience with. So over time hasn't figured out ways, or evolution hasn't figured out ways to use this stuff. So, you know, you can dump certain chemicals in the environment and they still can be in the exact same form in 100 years or 200 years. And with nuclear waste, you know, we talk about half-lives of hundreds of years or thousands of years. They can last a real long time. So what's the implications for all of that stuff for us as economists? What we might call a holistic view of production and consumption. It's important to distinguish between emissions and pollution. That's one thing I would get out of this conversation. Some emissions are neutral, some are bad, some are better. Are any emissions good? What do we call the emissions, say, of a factory that are good? We call those things the market commodities that the factory is going to sell, right? So yes, some of them are good. Now, if everything that goes in has to come out, the environment is the primary source of all inputs, the only way to have zero emissions is to have what? Yeah, zero production, zero consumption. To talk about zero emissions with positive and production and positive consumption doesn't make any sense. It defies the laws of physics. So that raises questions about reducing emissions or reducing pollution. Remember, all emissions aren't pollution. Oh, you know what? I gotta back up here for a second. I think I forgot something. Recycling. We should talk about it for a second. What is recycling? We take what? We take emissions, we take products that were produced that we either consider to be waste or we consider to be pollutants, and we mess with them to convert them back into something that will be nice to consume or can be used as an input in production. Again, it's a rearrangement. We take what? We take the waste product, we typically combine it with other products using what? Again, using energy to bring about the rearrangement to end up with these recycled products. Again, it takes energy, it takes other stuff, it's not a free good, and like standard production and standard consumption, it's not what? Well, it has emissions, yeah, there are emissions. Well, I don't know what the hell I was going to say. I guess I was just going to say, like production and consumption, it's a rearrangement driven by energy. So when we talk about pollution reduction, you know, there's a bunch of great quotes from Al Gore, for example. It says, we got to reduce pollution. Well, how do we do that? What are some of the, thinking about it in this materials balance framework, what are the different ways we could reduce pollution? One way to reduce pollution would be to do what? Reduce consumption and production.
You could make production more efficient.
Okay, let's be careful with that one. When you say make production more efficient, what do we mean?
Well, I'm just trying to think, like, do the same job in a shorter amount of time, you know, so you're making more, I guess, in the, I'm trying to think.
Now, if we could make baseball bats, right, mm-hmm. and get the exact same bat using less wood, there'd be less waste product in terms of wood.
You could sell the shavings to paper mills.
Maybe.
Change the process.
Well, when we think of efficiency, we can think of it in different ways. We can say efficiency in the use of wood. You know, like, do we want to produce baseball bats using the minimum amount of wood? And the answer to that might be we could. We probably wouldn't choose to do it that way because it would probably require what? A lot more labor and much better saws and all that kind of stuff.
Maybe efficiency in energy, like energy use? Mm. Yeah.
But also to make forests more natural, no? The fields.
A sharp saw is not necessarily a more efficient saw. You got to sharpen it, right? I mean, if we're talking about an economy where there's lots of labor, lots of saws, or what do I want to say? You know, a big saw blade, but not a lot of labor to sharpen it, you know, you're not necessarily going to spend all your labor sharpening the saw. You know, if there's a lot of wood around, you might say, what the hell, let's go with the dull saw. We got all this wood, and let's save the labor for something else. If it was possible to, say, have the exact same output from the factory and use less inputs, like reduce some of the inputs coming in the door without reducing any of the, or increasing any of the others, then we definitely say the process was inefficient, right? And if we could do that, now we got to be careful though, what do we mean then? If the same, if the amount of weight that came in the door goes down, then the amount of weight that goes out the door has to go down. Maybe what we could do though is the weight of the products we want to produce stay the same, the amount of inputs that come in the door stay the same or goes down, and the amount of waste materials go down. If we can do that, then yes, that would reduce emissions. Now that raises an interesting question. If a firm could do that, why the hell haven't they done it already? If firms can lower their cost of production, in the long run, they're probably going to do it. I mean, one reason they might not do it, and this goes to the issue of market failures, some of the inputs that firms use, they have to do what? Pay money for. Because they're commodities that are bought and sold in the marketplace. Other emissions or inputs, like air, for example, maybe, or water, they maybe get for free or at a subsidized price, so they don't give a shit how much of it they use. If they can use more of that and save some of the other stuff that they have to pay for, but yeah, if they could reduce the total amount coming in the door and keep constant the amount of product, positive product coming out the door, if they could do that before they do that, that's... So, one way to decrease emissions would be to increase efficiency in that sense. Another way would be to do what? Another way would be to just reduce production and consumption. But now, even with your argument, all those Barbies that came out the door are still going to end up back in the environment at some point. Did you guys read the article about Barbies recently? Yeah, 67% of girls in Britain mutilate their Barbies. They didn't do the study in the U.S., but Christine, have you ever mutilated a Barbie? No.
I mutilated G.I. Joes, I think, or those little plastic army men.
Yeah. Well, the little guys, I remember you could burn them with matches.
Do you mean mutilate and like cut the Barbie's hair?
Well, I don't know that I would call hair cutting a mutilation. Pardon?
I pierced my Barbie dolls.
You pierced your Barbie dolls? I was thinking of more stuff like breaking their legs, you know. Like my daughter, does she have any Barbie dolls? Yeah, she gets Barbie dolls from my brother, right? And I think maybe, you know, she likes to play they get sick and stuff like that. So occasionally I think a Barbie doll's gotten a broken leg. But I don't think she's ever like twisted their head off or anything like that. She actually has a big problem at the moment because she has an American Girl doll. Okay. You probably don't all know what American Girls are, but there's these expensive dolls that each one has a place in American history and all that. So she has one and it's losing its hair. So she's kind of bald in a gross kind of way, like she just went through months of chemotherapy. So sometimes we can play chemotherapy and stuff, but she's considering, we're talking about recycling here, she's considering having Kirsten's head replaced. But she's got great ambivalence about whether she wants to replace Kirsten's head or not. will Kirsten still be Kirsten if her head is replaced? Now, is that recycling or is that waste? I mean, she could have just gone out and bought another Kirsten, right? Less materials will be used if she just gets the head replaced. But the old heads, well, maybe they recycle the old heads, I don't know. Re-hair them or something like that. I don't know, it's like got these, they're embedded right in their skull and stuff. It's not just like they're pasted on, so you could just like scrape off the wig and put on a new wig. It actually goes right into, I don't know. Where were we? Pollution reduction, as compared to reducing waste or emissions. We could do what? We could hold inputs constant, we could hold production constant, consumption constant, have the exact same amount of waste as we've always had, but reduce pollution. How can we do that? That's often called pollution abatement. And what is that? That's when you take the emissions that are in some form we don't like, and we apply labor, capital, and energy to convert them from the noxious form they're in to a less noxious form. Somebody give me an example of that? Waste treatment. We take waste and we apply labor and capital to process the waste. What about exhaust from chimneys? Do we ever mess around with it?
Catalytic converters in cars.
We have catalytic converters in cars. We have scrubbers on chimneys that do what? The smoke and stuff has to pass through filters or liquids or whatever, and it does what? Does it make the stuff go away? It takes it out of the air and it turns it into a kind of sludge. You know, if we went to a big gigantic refinery that had big scrubbers on their smokestacks, some of those refineries, there's one in, I think, Thunder Bay, Canada, that will produce like a train load, I don't mean one car, but a whole train load of sludge every day from their scrubbers. 2 points here. One is pollution reduction isn't making the stuff go away, but it's doing what? It's transforming it from one form to another form. Now, why would we want to transfer it from one form to another form? It's less harmful. When we think about it that way, though, we get into a real issue here about it's not so much always a question of how much waste we're going to have, but kind of what form we want to take the waste or what form you want to have your poison. You know, imagine we have a certain amount of emissions and currently the factory is getting rid of those emissions by sending them up the smokestack. The government comes along and says, you can't do that. We want you to reduce air pollution. What are they going to do? Are they automatically going to cut back? If you say reduce air pollution by 30%, are they going to cut back production by 30%? Probably not. Probably what's more likely is they might reduce production by a percent or so, but probably not by very much. But now they've got to get rid of what? They've got to get rid of the waste somewhere else. And if it ain't going in the air, it's got to go either in the water or on the land. So all this materials balance stuff has a very important implication for policy in the sense that we can't regulate or think about controlling air pollution, say, independent of other sorts of pollutants. If you just dictate that we're going to reduce one kind of pollution, it's probably going to just cause an increase in another kind of pollution. Factories are trying to get rid of their junk in the cheapest possible way. If the cheapest possible way is currently to burn it, they're going to burn it. If you say you can't burn it, they're going to go with the next cheapest way, which might be run a pipe from the factory into the river. It's all got to stay in balance. I think we can finish this up here in a sec. We can reduce pollution by increasing recycling. That requires other inputs and energy. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is if we're going to use labor and capital and energy to change the form of emissions or to recycle or whatever, that means what? There's got to be unemployed labor, capital, and energy to use. If we were at full employment, there wouldn't be any extra labor and capital laying around to use to recycle or change the form of pollution. We got to think about it all in a general equilibrium picture. We can't think of different types of pollution in isolation. So, the view I'm trying to give you here is production, consumption, the environment, it's all part of the same system. What goes in must come out. So, why don't you guys ask me some things about KNESA on Tuesday? So, read the KNESA article. We'll talk a little bit about that on Tuesday.